get situated a minute here. Let me think. I asked Siri on the way up here. I now have 11,698 days of sobriety. That's 32 years last week. And I have a home group, and those of you who missed it this past week just missed a fantastic speaker. I really appreciate it. That's down in Cranesville on Tuesday night, out on Crane Road in the middle of nowhere. And I have a sponsor and a co-sponsor today. And before I get into step, what step am I doing? Oh, 10, yeah. I wanted to share a little bit more of the story of last week. When I was doing steps 8 and 9 last week, I talked about an extremely difficult amend that I had to make to my ex-husband. I was totally unwilling at the beginning. I had to pray for willingness and then pray for opportunity. Completely forgot that I needed to make amends to his parents also, whom I had not seen in many years. I don't know if it's who or whom. But in that conversation with him that night, or that day, whenever I talked to him on the phone, he called me, he mentioned that his parents were coming up from Florida, which is where they lived, the next week. And again, I went, oh, okay, God, I asked for willingness and opportunity. I guess this must be it, too. So I told him, I said, ask your parents if I could take them out to lunch at the Riverside while they're here. And his mother called me a couple days later when they were up here and said they would be happy to go out to lunch with me. And I made my amends to them. But Friday, right after I had just did the 8th and 9th steps here, I'm going through cleaning out a desk that I clean out. I said it well around. I clean it out once a year, once every 10 years, whether it needs it or not. And I ran into a letter that I got from my ex-mother-in-law after those amends. And in that letter, she invited me. She had done it verbally, and she invited me to come down and spend some time with them in Florida. So, whoa, it was like, yeah, these amends really, some of them are really, really powerful. But anyhow, that was my little side story. And now we're on to step 10. And as I have done each time, I look up the principle behind the steps. And according to what I have read, I always get more than one, almost always. It's vigilance or perseverance. So, and again, I've fallen into this routine of going to the dictionary, and I looked up the two words. And perseverance is defined as continued to do or achieve something despite difficulties, failures, or opposition. Vigilance is defined as the action or state of keeping careful watch for possible danger or difficulties. So, in step 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And you know, as I have studied these steps to come up and make a presentation on them, all of a sudden these principles are making more sense to me than they ever did before. And then there's a second little highlight. I knew I had something else to tell you. Last Monday, I went down for orientation at the Crawford County Jail. And what I have been asked to do is when individual residents of the Crawford County Correctional Facility want to work a step one-on-one with someone, I will be the one going in to work the steps with them. So it's pretty neat, pretty neat. Thank you very much for asking me to do this. I think that's going to be definitely going to be my reward, besides learning a whole lot of stuff. Okay, back to this 10th step, promptly. God, I hate that word, promptly. And of course, that's with little delay. Immediately is promptly. And I have one particular amends I had to make in sobriety that stands out in my mind that I had to make it promptly. And this was in the classroom. It wasn't Paula. I wasn't sober when Paula was my student. and I taught high school math, and sometimes teenagers can get a little smart-alecky, you know? Believe it or not. And I usually tried to handle it with some kind of humor. For example, the one time a girl needed some help, and she said, "Hey, dude." And I walked up to her, and I said, "That's Mrs. Dude to you." And she never called me dude again, you know? Like, but this girl aggravated me, or I don't know. But I lashed out at her with an insult. You know, today I try to put it through three filters. Is it true? Well, I don't know if this insult was true or not, but I insulted her. Is it kind? Definitely not. Is it necessary? Absolutely not. It was just my frustration lashing out. So, you know, I had been sober long enough that I knew I had to make amends to her. And what I really wanted to do was the next day when I saw her, just call her aside and say, you know, what I said yesterday to you was really unkind, and I will try very hard never to do that again. But that didn't sit right. I had insulted her in front of the whole class. So I had to make amends to her in front of the whole class. I couldn't do it one-on-one privately. It helped me hold my tongue in the classroom when anyone ticked me off. So that was probably, and I did it the next day, the next time I saw her. And you know, promptly, first thing that comes to mind is, it's the opposite of procrastination, you know? And I don't know, I might be the only alky in here that suffers from procrastination. I sort of doubt it, but I might be. And again, back to that dictionary. It's defined as the avoidance of doing a task that needs to be accomplished. Yes. It could be further stated as a habitual, intentional delay of starting or finishing a task despite its negative consequences. That sounds like me when I did my initial four-step. I put it off and I put it off, and I knew it needed to be done, but oh, I could, you know, come up with every excuse in the world. Today, I have improved. I definitely have improved a whole lot. Because, not so much because it's the right thing to do, I have this magic magnifying mind. I call it my MMM. And when there's a task that I need to accomplish, but I put it off, and I put it off, it has this tendency to grow in my mind until it becomes this overwhelming job that needs to be done. It might be a 15-20 minute task, but I have turned it into something almost impossible to do. And today I like to treat myself a little better than that. And I have actually cut way back on my procrastination. I won't say it's gone, but I've cut way back on it. So, Bill had some things to say on procrastination. And he starts out with it on page 85 from a Grapevine article. "In the first days of AA, I wasn't much bothered about the areas of life in which I was standing still. There was always the alibi. After all, I said to myself, I'm far too busy with much more important matters. That was my near-perfect prescription for comfort and complacency." And of course, we know today that complacency is a dangerous place for an alcoholic to be. And then he also said, well, this is actually from the 12 and 12, but I like it. "Procrastination is really sloth in five syllables." And, of course, sloth is, well, I always picture that animal that sort of moves along. I've never seen a sloth, to be honest with you, but I imagine what he looks like. "And my observation is that some people can get by with a certain amount of postponement, but few can live with outright rebellion." So, yeah, that was the first character defect I started looking at recently. And once more, I mentioned this back, I think, in the fourth step, and I'll mention it again. Now, according to Socrates, who some credit with a bit of wisdom, a quote from him is, "An unexamined life is not worth living." So in the tenth step, we are encouraged to take an examination of our life in each and every day, really, and spot checks in between. The other thing I was reading through this, and I had to look it up. It's from the book, big book, right in the middle of the 10th step, and it says, "Love and tolerance of others is our code." And again, powerful statement, but I had a dictionary. I love my dictionary. A code is a set of conventions or moral principles governing behavior in a particular sphere. So for us in AA, the two most important moral principles are love and tolerance. And of course, tolerance is the ability or the willingness to allow the existence of opinions or behaviors that one dislikes or disagrees with without interference. Your higher power doesn't match my higher power? It doesn't matter. It does not matter. You pick your higher power. I pick my higher power. All that's really important is in here is that we have one. And also accepting people as they are. I thought I had a... Well, I don't know. I'll find it. Then I looked up the definition of love. And oh, in the dictionary, it's sort of mushy, you know. And again, my higher power was at work when I was looking these things up, because the definition I found for love is from Scott Peck, and I love his writings, and he defines love as caring for or nurturing another person's soul or spirit. And I just love that. You know, every AA meeting is an expression of love, because we come in here to nurture one another's spirits, to lift them, to help one another through this life, you know? I just love that definition of love. And, you know, the longer I've stayed sober, and I hated hearing this when I was a newcomer, I hated it. The longer I stay sober, the more narrow the road becomes. You know, and back they talked about that archway at the beginning. You know, it was a nice wide archway that anyone could fit through, you know. All we had to have was willingness. Well, the longer I've stayed sober, and if I want to continue to grow, that road has become narrower and narrower. That I have to adhere to these principles more often than I ever did before. And, you know, I have to do more. I cannot stay sober today on yesterday's program. It just won't happen. Each and every day, I have to do something to continue to push myself a little further, a little more along. I'm either moving forward or I'm sliding back. There's no treading water in AA. You know, I'm either making progress or I'm going backwards. But thank goodness that it's progress, not perfection. You know, there's no way, shape, or form I'm anywhere near perfection. But I like to keep looking at it, but, you know, maybe get a little tiny bit closer today in one area, of course, in another area. And so I brought tonight they're up here. A daily inventory that I use. My coffee is blue here, and it's only a little coffee stained. I didn't have any blue paper to run it off in blue, but I finally put it in a sleeve because I kept spilling coffee on it. But what I have done for the remainder of this time is taking a look at, this has personality characteristics of self-will and personality characteristics of God's will or higher power. And so it's not only taking a look at what I have done poorly on during the day, it's also a list of things that I've done pretty well. On the back of this is one I picked up here. Jazz pointed it out to me. It's from Al-Anon. And I'm not criticizing Al-Anon because it saved my life. I have a son who finally decided to stop drinking. But theirs is much more detailed. And there's some neat stuff in here. And I glance at it. It's way too much for late at night. And so one of them, of course, is on here is procrastination, I think. Well, maybe not. But anyhow, I've talked about that one enough. So, the one I wanted to talk about, of course, is the one I can still fall into very, very easily, and that's self-pity. And self-pity is a self-indulgent dwelling on one's own sorrows or misfortunes. A feeling of pity for yourself because you believe you have suffered more than is fair or reasonable. Pour me. Pour me. Pour me a drink. You know? I can remember when I was... when I was still teaching, and the kids would want the kids to say, well, that's not fair. And I always say to them, whoever told you life is fair lied to you, you know? But for myself, I'd like it to be fair. The word that is often used to describe a state of self-pity is wallowing in self-pity. And wallowing is lying about in mud or water, you know? I always think about pigs wallowing. And am I completely free from self-pity today? No. No. There are times I indulge. I'm still prone to, you know, I can tell you everything that's gone wrong in my life and leave out all those great things that have happened. I'm more inclined that way. So, what does Bill have to say about self-pity? And he does. And this is from a letter he wrote back in 1946, before I could even read it. Those other people. Just like you, I have often thought myself the victim of what other people say and do. Yet every time I confess the sins of such people, especially those whose sins did not correspond exactly with my own, I found that I only increased the total damage. My own resentment, my self-pity, would often render me well-nigh useless to anybody. So nowadays, if anyone talks of me so as to hurt, I first ask myself if there is any truth at all in what they say. If there is none, I try to remember that I too have had my periods of speaking bitterly of others, that hurtful gossip is but a symptom of our remaining emotional illness. I like that one. And consequently, that I must never be angry at the unreasonableness of sick people. Under very trying conditions, I have had again and again to forgive others, also myself. Have you tried this recently? I'm not asking you. That's what Bill said right there in that letter he wrote back in 1946. So, you know, I guess at least Bill had some self-pity going on, even if nobody else in this room has ever suffered from the black balloon syndrome. Another character defect that I pulled off there that... And I pulled the ones off that related to me, you know, and looked those up. Selfishness. Selfishness is being concerned excessively or exclusively for one's own advantage, pleasure, or welfare, regardless of others at all. Well, I have selective selfishness. You know, some days I can be as giving, doing, willing to, some days. If I don't have plans. Now, these might be stupid plans, but they're my plans, you know? And I try to remember, and sometimes more successfully than others, that most of my plans today are just that, my plans. They're not written in stone. If somebody calls and needs to talk for an hour and I was going to clean the refrigerator, so what? You know? Today, because I've avoided procrastination a little bit more, it used to be that was a sign that I didn't have to clean the refrigerator, you know. Now I talked on the phone, so I'll do that tomorrow. But, you know, after I get off the phone, I could even put the phone on speaker and continue to do the task at hand. That was my plan. None of my plans today are that great. Well, some of them are pretty good, you know, when I decide to go on vacation or something, or if I have a football game that I have. And when I sponsor someone, and I learned this from my sponsor, please, unless it's a dire emergency, do not call me while the Steelers are playing. And now I've added two more teams to that, Thomas Jefferson High School and Pitt, because I have grandchildren playing there. So Bill addressed some selfishness. And what did he have to say here? 81, there it is. I can see why you are disturbed to hear some AA speakers say, AA is a selfish program. The word selfish ordinarily implies that one is acquisitive, demanding, and thoughtless of the welfare of others. Of course, the AA way of life does not at all imply such undesirable traits. What do these speakers mean? Well, any theologian will tell you that the salvation of his own soul is the highest vocation that a man can have. Without salvation, however we may define this, he will have little or nothing. For us of AA, there is even more urgency. If we cannot or will not achieve sobriety, then we become truly lost, right in the here and now. We are of no value to anyone, including ourselves, until we find salvation from alcohol. Therefore, our own recovery and spiritual growth have to come first, a right and necessary kind of self-concern. So that, you know, I've heard that, and it did cause me some discomfort when the speaker would say, well, this is a selfish program. But Bill just explained it all in a letter that he wrote back in 1966. So, and then he also had another, let me see if it's a letter or not. Yeah, it's another letter from 1958, a little bit later. I don't know. Oh, I see it. Among AAs, there's still a vast amount of mix-up respecting what is material and what is spiritual. If we use our worldly possessions too selfishly, then we are materialists. But if we share these possessions in helpfulness to others, then the material aids the spiritual. So, again, you know, speaking against selfishness. So, well, you know, that's enough of my character defects, so let's go on to some desirable. I could go on through the whole list if, yeah, shut up. I've known you way too long, Chaz. A lot of these people, well, not a lot in this room, weren't born when I met you, so. Tolerance. And I talked a little bit at the beginning about our code. Love and tolerance is our code in AA. And Bill had a lot to say about tolerance. And the first one is a Grapevine article from 1946 again. Troublemakers can be teachers. Few of us are any longer afraid of what, that's what it says. Few of us are any longer afraid of what any newcomer can do to our AA reputation or effectiveness. Those who slip, those who panhandle, those who scandalize, those with mental twists, those who rebel at the program, those who trade on the AA reputation. All such persons seldom harm an AA group for long. Some of these have become our most respected and best loved. Some have remained to try our patience, sober nevertheless. Others have drifted away. We have begun to regard the troublesome ones not as menaces, but rather as our teachers. They oblige us to cultivate patience, tolerance, and humility. We finally see that they are only people sicker than the rest of us. That we who condemn them are the Pharisees, whose false righteousness does our group the deeper spiritual harm. Damage. Harm. Yeah. For some reason, this just came to mind. Quite a few years ago, there was a woman who lived pretty close to me who asked me to be her sponsor. And I said, well, you call me. Well, this woman did not smell very good, ever. And I got on the phone to Beverly. And I explained the situation to Beverly. And she said, if she asked you again, you will say yes. I went, oh. She never asked me again. But yeah, I mean, you know, because I didn't want to sponsor her because she didn't smell good. Jeez, oh man, well, yeah. Hopefully I've made some progress since then. Then, in AA comes of age, a quote from Bill. All kinds of people have found their way into AA. Not too long ago, I sat talking in my office with a member who bears the title Countess. That same night, I went to an AA meeting. It was winter, and there was a mild-looking little gent taking the coats. I said, who's that? And somebody answered, oh, he's been around for a long time. Everybody likes him. He used to be one of Al Capone's mob. That's how universal AA is today. So, yeah, you know, Yale or jail. You know, I've heard that expression in these rooms. And people who would not normally mix. And a garbage man and a college prof, right? Yeah. And then he also had to say in a letter, 1949, this is a letter to a prison group that he wrote. Every AA has been, in a sense, a prisoner. Each of us has walled himself out of society. Each has known social stigma. The lot of you folks has been even more difficult. In your case, society has also built a wall around you. But there isn't any really essential difference, a fact that practically all AAs now know. Therefore, when you members come into the world of AA on the outside, you can be sure that no one will care a fig that what you have done. What you are trying to be, not what you were, is all that counts with us. And that's pretty neat. And, you know, I used to go into the Cambridge prison, state correctional facility in Cambridge Springs. And, you know, listening to those women, I could have done what any one of them did in the blackout and not know it. Absolutely not know it. The difference was that, you know, I didn't. Thank God. And again on tolerance. Two, three, four. That's a tough one. Two, three. Two. Well, there it is. No, that was the one I just read. Okay, one more. 312. He says something on tolerance. And again, a letter. Tolerance keeps us sober. Honesty with ourselves and others gets us sober. But it is tolerance that keeps us that way. Experience shows that few alcoholics will long stay away from a group just because they don't like the way it is run. Most return and adjust themselves to whatever conditions they must. Some go to form a different group, or some go to a different group, or form a new one. In other words, once an alcoholic fully realizes that he cannot get well alone, he will somehow find a way to get well and stay well in the company of others. It has been that way from the beginning of AA and probably will always be so. From 1943. So AA was very, very young, 8 years old at that time when he wrote this. And the other, tolerance, yeah, I'm most of the time pretty good at that. Gotten better. Patience is another asset. And it's defined as the capacity to accept or tolerate delay, trouble, or suffering without getting angry or upset. Oh yeah, that 12 and 12 states. It is a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there is something wrong with us. You know, and I finally gave up counting the number of items that people have in the fast checkout in the grocery store. You can't believe how many times I got aggravated. I'm standing there with one thing, and it says 10, and I can count to 12 because I know my numbers. Was she wrong? He wrong? Whoever had 12 items in their cart? Or was I the one? I got upset. I'm better in grocery stores. In fact, I every once in a while, when I have a fairly good-sized cart and someone comes right behind me with 3 or 4 items, I don't even tell them to go to the self-checkout. I don't even think it as much as I used to, and sometimes I will let them go ahead of me. Sometimes, yeah. But then there's that driving situation. And did I tell this already in here? Leaving the woman's retreat up at Findlay Lake? Oh, very spiritual weekend. Just feeling, oh, life is good. It's getting on 90 to come home. Somebody cut me off. The words that came out of my mouth, I was like, oh my, and then I started laughing. I thought, oh woman, you just spent all this weekend getting filled up and you just blew it all because somebody cut you off. Yeah, I'm still not real patient at driver. But every once in a while, I think about a story I heard a lot of years ago, and then I'll shut up here one more. This guy was really impatient. He was driving, and the person in front of him was going way too slow. Well, a few weeks later, he was moving, and he had an aquarium. And he didn't want to empty it all the way and take all the fish out, so he emptied it down partway, and he had it in the back seat of his car. But he's driving very slowly so that this water does not slosh out. So from then on, when he got behind someone driving slower than he wanted to be going, he thought, well, maybe they're moving their aquarium, you know, and settled himself down right away. So my last quote from Bill, welcome criticism. A letter from 1955. Thanks much for your letter of criticism. I'm certain that had it not been for its strong critics, AA would have made slower progress. For myself, I have come to set a high value on people who have criticized me, whether they have seemed reasonable critics or unreasonable ones. Both have often restrained me from doing much worse than I actually have done. The unreasonable ones have taught me, I hope, a little patience. But the reasonable ones have always done a great job for all of AA and have taught me many a valuable lesson. So I will close it with the 10-step prayer that I say daily, And it's a very short one. How can I best serve thee? Thy will be done. Thank you. I don't get to sit down.
And now we have question and answer. I think it's working. Can you hear me over there, guys? Does anybody have a question for Helen?
Oh, I knew it. I had him in the classroom too, like that, you know?
Thanks, Helen. Yeah, I appreciate you coming out. I have one question. You were talking about when you occasionally fall into self-pity.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do to get yourself out of that situation?
Gratitude list. I found myself, over a year ago, about a year ago now, and I couldn't figure out if I was still in mourning or if this was self-pity, because it was feeling like self-pity. And so it was suggested to me, every morning before I got out of bed, I wrote down three things I was grateful for that day. And I absolutely believe that gratitude is my antidote for self-pity. Okay.
Anybody else?
Jerome.
Thanks, Helen. So it says continue to take personal inventory. So it's somehow related to the fourth step, the tenth step, and why is there such a big space between that? And how would I know that they're related?
Well, let me think. Tenth step is the first of the maintenance steps, and why is there such a big gap? Well, I guess I needed to take care of some character defects, or at least be willing to take care of some character defects and clean up some of the wreckage of the past by making amends before I was ready to do it on a daily basis. And there have been times where I, rather than just a 10th step, I have redone a 4th and 5th because I let garbage pile up too high. But I always think of this, you know, like for me, doing that 4th and 5th step the first time is sort of like planting that new garden, you know, tilling up that soil, getting that manure in there and shoveling it out. And then the 10th step is going back and weeding that garden to make sure that it still looks good. I don't know if I've answered why the big gap, but okay. Thanks, Jerome.
All right, thank you, Helen.